And it's my great pleasure and honor at this point, as your chair, to introduce our speakers. We have our first speaker is a gentleman by the name of Bill Minter from Cape Girardeau. I'll let him clarify that, from Missouri. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you very much. I am Bill Minter. I am alcoholic. What a great, great honor, really, to be here for this. I wrote down some notes this morning. Primarily, they say, your name is Bill Minter and you're alcoholic. The topic, the sense of belonging. The guy that sent my name in said if I would try to stick to the subject, he would greatly appreciate it. But I mean what I'm saying about being grateful. This is such a big, big thing for me, as I'm sure it is for you. I got sober in March of 1975. That June, about this time, about this same time of year, 30 years ago, I was sitting around the club in Dallas, and two guys who had done the program had worked very well for them, and they were doing quite well, and they were having a discussion about going to the International. That year it was in Denver. The thing I remember most about the conversation was what shoes they were going to take to Denver. And, of course, I wasn't involved in the conversation, but it went on for quite some time. And the only thing I could think about was I had just gotten sober. The shoes I had were a pair of these patent leather loafers that had been tassel loafers at one time. The tassels were gone. They had these little snail-looking things on them, and there were no bottoms in them. And I thought, you know, I guess going to that International would be okay, but it'd really be nice to have a pair of shoes. But I am tickled to death to be here. The other thing I want to mention briefly, everybody that I've heard talk has embarrassed somebody. The man, a very good friend of mine who took me to my first meeting in 1975, there was no reason for me to go to AA, I want you to understand that, because I was not alcoholic, but the man who told me, he said, Bill, all I can offer you is take you to a meeting of AA. The man is with me today. We've been friends since 1968. We drank for 7 years, and we've been around this program for 30. Jim, I want you to stand up and embarrass yourself. Let's go! I am grateful. I do remember the topic. Some things I wanted to point out in the process. In my childhood, and these are really pathetic little tales, but I mean, they're in my childhood, grandfather had told my mother, said he wouldn't help her out, but he said, if you would get rid of that kid, I would be glad to help you out. Now, that could have been kept a secret, but it kept coming up in my life. And even my mother wrote a little biography one time and pointed that out. But that was part of it. And I think that began a process of my brother and I. We stayed in some foster homes. I never really understood that. They had their own children. We were just kind of there. And my mother would come visit, and I would walk her to the bus station. At the bus stop, and I had no idea why we couldn't go with her. And that kind of became a pattern. My grandmother, God bless her, and I am over this, I think, but she did volunteer to drive us up to Guthrie, Oklahoma, to the Masonic home. Unfortunately, they were full, so we didn't get to go to the Masonic home, even after they told us what a great time we were going to have at the Masonic home. But anyway, as this went along, with not much information on how to live life, I was kind of left with making the decisions and the calls on my own. My first, as I recall, I decided to be a football player. Several things went wrong with that. Number one, I wouldn't tell them the actual right size of my shoes. I had big feet, didn't want to have big feet, and that's when I guess I started learning that. If you don't want big feet, you just don't have big feet. But it's very, very difficult to play football in shoes that are about two sizes too small. It's very difficult to play football if you have no courage and no ability and big feet. Later on, I got out of high school. I ended up not doing well in high school, but I decided to go in the Army. I knew that my mission in life was to become a man, and I was kind of having to make those up, like I said. I thought, two reasons I went in the Army. One, I didn't want to go look for a job. And the other was, I had always been impressed by people that went in the Army, and I thought if I went in the Army, then you would be impressed. You would say, well, hell, he must be a man. He's in the Army. Bad thing about the Army, they tell you what to do. I'm not a guy who listens well or pays attention or who will abide by the rules. I went in a private, got out a private. I got out honorably, but I mean well, but I'm not a good trooper, you know. That didn't work to fulfill that need to be a man. Later, I went to college because the other big boys went to college. I talked to a counselor, I think, the first day. My mother took me to college to enroll me, kind of like the second grade. I know she knew that if she didn't take me, I would not get there. But I got enrolled, did talk to a counselor, my major was business. I wasn't sure what that meant, but I knew you had to have one. At some point in that deal, I decided to major in psychology. I went to school for about 2.5-3 years, got ready for a checkup on that, and only to discover that, and I've been taking a lot of psychology courses, only to discover they didn't offer a degree in psychology. I was pretty upset about that. And it was a teaching school. I mean, it was like a teacher's college. And all these psychology courses had been, teaching things. I dropped out of school because I felt like I'd been misled. I don't know where I heard they had a degree in psychology, but a little later on, one of the things I tried was I decided to be a race car driver. I had been impressed by that before, and I thought, if you did that, they would have to know. So I got a car and I fixed it up and went to the driving school and got the license and did a little bit of racing. The problems with that was I didn't have the money, really, for one thing, and it scared me a lot. So I didn't do real well at that, and I didn't do it very long either. I'm sure I came up with some great excuse for getting out of it, but I really wanted to do it. I just wasn't able. Many, many things. I don't mean to belabor this. I got married a couple of times. I learned after coming to Alcoholics Anonymous that marriage is for adults. It's not intended for people like me. It's very, very important that you grow up before you try that. And two nice ladies, wasn't a thing in the world wrong with them except bad judgment. And, I could not do that. I bought a couple of houses, by the way, that I couldn't afford the houses. So needless to say, I couldn't put the yard in. These were nice neighborhoods. That's how I operate. I like this neighborhood. So this is where I want to live. Now, it's really bad when people on all sides of you have these beautiful lawns and you got this rock collection out there. And And you finally get some grass, and but it's the wrong kind of grass. And I looked out my, I heard noise outside my den window one morning, and I thought, what is that? It was Sunday morning. One of the neighbors was edging my yard. And I got into, early on, I started going to church, looking for probably what I found here. I'm sure I was looking for something. I tried all the churches. Initially, it started off, I was, whoever was going to camp is the church I liked the most. And I was a royal ambassador, as I recall, in the Baptist church, just during camp. And I don't know what the Methodists were, but I went there. Later, I joined the Catholic church. I had only met one Catholic. Nobody in my family, I don't think, had ever met a Catholic. I grew up outside in Oklahoma City. That was really an evil thing to do. They were pretty busy hating the Indians, but they really hated the Catholics. And I had a little of both going for me. You know, my dad was Indian enough that he should have stayed away from the firewater. But I joined the Catholic Church, and it got a lot of attention from people in the family, which is what it was all about. I'm not a good Catholic. The things they were talking about scared me. I knew I was going to hell. And they told me that the only way I was going to get out, you had to get a bunch of other Catholics to kind of pray you out. You go to purgatory or wherever that is, and if people prayed hard enough and lit enough candles, you could bust out. Well, hell, I was the only Catholic I knew. So I thought, that ain't going to happen. But really later I tried, I was a Nazarene for a while out in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Not a good Nazarene. They wouldn't let me join because I smoked. I thought, you people don't have a clue, do you? That's probably one of the only good things about me, if you really knew. I got into sales. Now, I want to tell you something. I'm a total introvert. So I go into sales. If my wife didn't meet people, I would know nobody. She introduces me to people, and then it kind of gets going. But I mean, but I wanted to be a salesman. I'd worked in a drugstore when I was a kid, and I mean, there were salesmen coming in there to have coffee, and I thought they were so cool. And I got some jobs. I scammed my way into. No way was I qualified for them. They were just painful. They were just painful. It was like all the other things I'm sharing with you. I finally got into pharmaceutical sales, I mean, which was like a double bad. I mean, now I'm a total introvert. I got an inferiority complex, and my job and my mission in life is to deal with people who have rather large egos, which put us even further apart. But my point about all this is all of my life, I insisted on doing things that just didn't make any sense. I'm a classified sections newspaper reader. If you want to know what jobs are available in Toronto, you call me at my hotel. I read them every day. I know exactly what's going on in the, but the way I shop for jobs is by the benefits. I don't pay much attention to the requirements. You know, if they got, I remember air travel cards and a company car, expense account. I thought, that's me. That's me. And I would proceed to try to get those jobs, and some of them I fell into. And I always failed. Always failed. And the drinking always got worse. I guess I ought to mention drinking. It was just continued, and it always got worse. Responsibility was the curse in my life, and the more, and that, it was just like drinking. The more, you know, I see the problem as the solution. Drinking I saw as a solution. You said that's the problem. I said you don't understand. Responsibility, it turns out, was the problem. And I saw responsibility as the solution. If I had more responsibility, I'd straighten up. How we doing? All right. My point here is, the downside of this, when I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous, which if you asked me what the problem was, what I would tell you and did, and what I hear all the time is, you know, I just never felt like I belonged. You know, I look back on that, I think, you know why I felt that way? Hell, I never belonged. That's not a false feeling. The people that I listen to, they say, I just feel uncomfortable. I don't feel like I belong. I mean, you don't. You know, back it up a little bit. Get in a situation where you do belong. I insisted on keeping myself in situations where I could not cut it. I belonged to a country club in Dallas for 3 years. Paid dues. Loved it. I was so proud of that. Never set foot in the clubhouse. I just paid the money, and I had a card, you know. But, I mean, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says you've got to become right size. And once I became right size, then I did have NAA, that sense of belonging. I've only had it here. The first time I really, really felt that, they asked me to be the CHIP chairman at my group in Dallas. I'm going to tell you something. Y'all have probably met some fine ship chairmen. You've never seen one this good. I worked that job to death. Call people at work. Hey, don't ever call here again. But again, I know this is where I belong. This is the first time in my life I ever felt that way. And after a while, I did have a sense of belonging. I understand the rules here. I was never anywhere where I understood, not the rules, but I know what's going on. You know, when I went to the first grade, I know I thought everybody else already knew all that crap. You know, and I didn't know any of it. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and finally I understood. And my life has just, it's just been like a dream, really. My big problem was always, I have, and like many people I know, but I can tell you about me, I refuse to do anything that I have the ability to do. I always want to do something I have no ability to do and stay out there where it's really uncomfortable. Today, I do things that I'm comfortable with, and if I'm uncomfortable with them, I quit doing them. And that's what this program taught me, to become right size. And if you really want to have that sense of belonging, then come on in here and be a member. You know, give up being different. Don't be different. Look for the, you know, once I see the sameness, then I belong. And I'm, you know, I had never belonged anywhere in my life. And I do belong here. I can't thank you enough, for allowing me to come here. It just blows my mind that I would be here 30 years later when I never, ever intended to stay here. I came here like a lot of people, just get the heat off. I needed a place to live. I needed a job. I needed a bigger car. I was the only guy in Dallas, Texas that had a Volkswagen. You may not believe that, but it's true. But I am terribly, terribly grateful. It's good to be here, and I've enjoyed every minute. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Bill. As you're going through all those lists of choices and places and things you did, trying to find a place to belong and making those neurotic decisions where we go in two directions at once, I couldn't help but get an image of myself when I used to go for from one bar to another, you know. And I'd go in a bar and I'd look around and, you know, maybe have a couple drinks and I don't know what I was looking for. And then I'd go on to another bar and I'd look around and, no, this wasn't it, and I'd go on to another one. And today I know what that is. I was looking for me, you know. And they say salvation is a coming home, and I walked in those doors 6.5 years ago, and thank God you people were here. And thank God people, like the people we're hearing today, shared their experience, strength, and hope with me. Because when I listened to your stories, I found me. And I found out that I'm okay today. So with that, I'd like to introduce Bob. Bob McCarroll from Underhill, Vermont, to share about his sense of belonging.
Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you can hear me. There's not a lot of voice left in there. My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. That's probably the most important thing I know about myself today. You know, being typical alcoholic, I've known about that I was going to speak here a long time. And I ignored it. And now I'm not going to think about it. But these last few weeks, I said, I better start doing something. So I put that off. I figured, well, these last few days, I better start doing something. So I sat down, it's been a couple of nights, a few days ago, and I wrote this whole thing out. I had it all planned out, because I wanted to sound good to you guys. Yeah. And I wrote it, and I read it, and I wrote it, and I read it. And I figured, well, maybe I ought to change this. Well, I figured all out this morning when I was talking to a couple other alcoholics. We came up with the best idea, and I threw it all away. So I've got no idea what you're going to hear. Right? But I know I belong here. Before I get into my story, you know, I believe there's no mistakes in life. I was really looking forward to this. I had thought about it. I knew years ago that it was going on. I said, I'd really like to go there because 40 years ago, they had the 30th International Convention in Toronto. And I heard all the stories about it, and I thought it sounded pretty neat because I was pretty busy out drinking about that, and I was just getting going in my career. And my dad was here speaking. 40 years later, I'm standing here, and my daughter's sitting there. If I can regroup from that. You know, it's like everybody's already said, and I was no different. You know, where the hell did I belong? You know, and everything I did to try and fit in, I tried to say what you want. I thought you wanted to hear, do what you wanted me to do, be what you wanted me to do. Every time I turned a corner, you know, likewise, I didn't belong. Did all the same things. I tried the military, too. Can't suggest the Navy is a good place to sober up. Went through that, and they kind of frowned on. I was a manipulator, so I got to be pretty good at what I was doing. And I had to show everybody all along. And what we ended up with is a 21-year-old in charge of a missile system with 16 nuclear warheads. And a bar built inside the equipment. Not a good idea. The Navy figured out it maybe didn't belong there either, and I moved on to other things. I won't get into the whole story, but I was starting to run out of countries to do geographic tours to. You know, but the problem was I always bought me. And I was still trying to fit in. It just didn't work. I rearranged my life very neatly all around alcohol. I was in the bar business. That's where I belong, not missile systems. I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous was. like I said, my dad had gone in there just about the time my drinking career was taken off. He got sober in 1960. Sounded like a good idea. I saw the changes, but I spent the next years trying to prove that I didn't belong here. Right? It was a conscious thought. I don't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. Never dawned on me. Normal people didn't think about that. I did. I tried really hard to prove I didn't belong here. Even after I walked in the rooms, I approached AA the same way that I approached the rest of my life. I wanted to walk in the doors and tell you what you wanted to hear. Right? And I was the guy sitting in the back evaluating what you had to say and evaluating this program and trying to figure out how it should apply to me. Which steps, which parts, applied to Bob. And I'd sit there and listen and go around and around on this. I confused working the steps with reading the steps. It wasn't part of my life. And surprisingly, it didn't work. I kept going to my sponsor and saying, the program doesn't work. It's not working for me. He had the answer. Just like all the others, because his sponsor told him. The program worked just fine. I didn't work the program. I was working Bob's Anonymous. Let me tell you, Bob's Anonymous does not work worth a damn, and I was the only member. Don't bother. I continued on, in and out, putting together various periods of dry time. Never what I now call sober time, and never feeling like I was really part of it. You never know when it's going to hit. For me, it was after, wrecking a couple of marriages, running out of countries to go to, wrecking, I think it was 36 cars at the last count, and a few other things. I was sitting in a traffic light one day in Burlington, Vermont, which, by the way, I had moved to Colorado. My first one day in Colorado, came to Burlington, went into a meeting. I can't tell you what happened in that meeting, who was there, what was discussed, or anything about it, but I knew I didn't like it. He didn't do it like we did. So I walked out. I didn't need it. Didn't take a long time, and I was back out there again. And this one day, I was sitting in a traffic light, and I was thinking about what I had to tell the people I worked for, how I had to manipulate that situation, what I had to tell my wife, how to manipulate that situation. And I was, I had all this stuff going on, right? And all of a sudden, a thought came to me, that little moment of clarity. All this time, I went to AA, first time to approach a judge, a couple wives, a few girlfriends, and various other people on the way. I did it for every other reason except me. Right? And it finally dawned on me, if I don't do this for me, all this stuff's gone anyway. So what difference does it make? Right? I need to do this for me. And for the first time, I called up somebody I already knew in the program, and I quit working Bob's Anonymous. I said, I don't know. Obviously, I have no clue what's going on. Help me. I finally reached, how I reached that bottom wasn't important. The point is I got where we all end up. That point of desperation where we finally get that gift of willingness to listen to what you had to say. I quit trying to tell you how I was going to sober up, and you told me. The answer was simple. It's a simple spiritual thing. I didn't want to hear anything about religion. Simple spiritual thing. I needed a higher power. I needed help. Right? The only thing my sponsor told me that was important I needed to know about a higher power was that I wasn't it. Right? And that turned out to be good advice. My higher power has changed a whole lot over the years. I can't draw you a picture of it. I don't bother describing. The thing is, finally I was in this place, three people understood. You'd have all those same crazy thoughts. You wouldn't have been laughing at that stuff we're saying. And I found a home. And I knew now that I've got to keep on doing the same basic things that I did when I first came in the rooms and got sober. So I'd like to hopefully not run out of time and share a couple of stories with you. Again, there's no mistakes in life. Now, fortunately, the last few years, I've gotten to travel around a whole lot. One of the first things I do is call up and find out where there's going to be an AA meeting. Coming up here, right, talking about, Jesus came to me international. I wonder if this guy's going to be here from this country and this guy's going to be here from that country. So I've gotten to be in a lot of them. I don't know. But that's a part of the story that I was writing out. I was with my friends over the last couple of days and said, God, one of those stories in Russia, there's somebody here from Russia. I'd really like to meet that guy. I just did. The first meeting I went to in Moscow, Russia, is his own group. Go figure. I can go anywhere in the world today and feel comfortable. AA is getting everywhere. Unfortunately, still got some work to be done for all of us because the message still needs to be spread a little bit. I had to travel outside of Russia. I was down in a city called Penza. There was no AA there. Boy, I couldn't wait to get to a meeting. And I called up and I knew I was going to Samara and there was a whole bunch of meetings. I had to Samara and I'm with these couple of people that are very non-alcoholic. I said, here's an address. Can you get me there? Oh, yeah, we'll take you. We got to this place, and it was a treatment center in Samara, Russia. And I saw the building when they finally found it, and it was kind of dark. And as we got closer, I was getting more comfortable, and these two were getting a little more nervous. And there's people standing outside, just kind of talking. And I said, look, do me a favor. When we go in there, can you come in with me? You don't have to stay. And ask if there's anybody that does speak English. It's not important to me because I don't fit in any meeting anymore. I lost that attitude in Burlington. I don't care what language you're reading steps in. I know there's 12 of them. I know what you're saying. I don't have to understand you. Okay? We walked in that room and there was 30, 40 people, all different kinds, men, women, old, and men. I asked that one over there. I could tell that was the chairperson. Holding the papers. The answer was no. It's okay, sit down. They decided to stay with me. Well, we got into it. Of course, they're reading in Russian. My two friends understood all this. And about the time they're going around the room and introducing themselves as alcoholics and addicts. And these guys decided it was a little scary and decided to tell me that this was not a safe place to be. We needed to leave. And so I'm quite comfortable. I'm doing fine. I'm feeling at home. And they looked at me again and said, well, we kind of need to leave. And I said, well, pick me up in an hour. I figured the meeting's probably an hour long, as most places. I'll never forget the look on their face walking out the door. Like they were never going to see me alive again. The meeting went on. People came in. People went out. Somebody was in a corner making a phone call. All of a sudden, this big guy came in the door. Everybody, a few people knew him. All of a sudden, musical chairs are going on. Seat next to me opens up. Guy sat down, leaned over and said, hi, I'm Bushy, alcoholic. They had taken the time. I was just another, they had another alcoholic there. And they needed a meeting, and they didn't have that didn't speak the language. They took the time to call somebody who took the time to drive in 20 miles or so, so you could talk to another alcoholic. That's malarkey. One more story. I'll quit. I have no idea where I'm at the time. I had an opportunity to go down to, I was in Peru, and a smaller city in the south called Arequipa. and my daughter was with me. And we decided to have one final meeting. So, again, got an address, give it to a taxi driver, and we're going up. And outside the city, so, you know, city's getting kind of quick there, and it turns into the Bar Hills. And it's poor. And the roads are getting narrower and narrower, and there's no more street signs. The taxi cab driver's figuring out where he's going by stopping the cab and yelling in the window to some lady. And we got up as far as he could go. And he's pointing up this hill. It's a little alleyway. She and I got out and walked up the alleyway. Same thing. I can see people standing out there. I'm getting more comfortable. There's a little door about that tall, about that wide. Next to it was a circle and triangle painted in white paint on the side of this building. We were there. Didn't speak the language. Right, so there's a couple of guys out there smoking a cigarette. I took off my medallion and handed it to him. Right? He knew. We were in this house with about 30 people. And it happened to be the third, I believe it was the third anniversary of the group in Arequipa. This outside of Arequipa. And meeting went on. Same thing. The topic was fellowship. And I understand a little bit of Spanish. My daughter is a little bit better. Unfortunately, there was a Mexican worker who was there that spoke a little bit of English and sat next to us. Same thing was going around. We didn't have to understand every word. They're all working the same program, and we all found the same solution. That's what we've got in common. Not that we drank. Right? What we got in common is the solution that we found. There's an answer. They went around and went to this meeting. And they're sharing on the fellowship, how it saved their lives. And they're sharing their bread and tea with us. And it got to the end of the meeting. And there was one older gentleman sitting up kind of in the corner. And he was last. They called on him. And he leaned forward and in Spanish. He looked, he just leaned over. And he looked and he said, "They may not look like me, but that's my brother and that's my sister." And he sat down, and the meeting ended. We belonged. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. That was great. Bill remarked just before the meeting that at one time 50% of the fellowship was named Bob, and the other 50% was named Bill. Talking about a sense of belonging, just before we introduced the pretty set part of the program here, was everyone in the Sky Dome last night? How was that? I call this conference rocket fuel. You know what I mean? You got the buzz? Right on. So it's a great honor to introduce Mary Branch from Cleveland, Ohio. I hear good things about Cleveland. Want to come visit someday? Welcome, Mary.
Whew. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mary Branch, and I am an alcoholic. First of all, I would like to thank my higher power, whom I choose to call God, and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for being alive and sober today. February the 14th, 1976, I came to you in a lot of pain, feeling a lot of remorse and guilt and not expecting to live. And here I stand this afternoon thanks to the committee, the International Committee, for inviting me to share with you in the celebration of our 70th anniversary. That's a miracle. I feel very humble and honored to be here today because God has allowed me to see my youngest son come into the fellowship. I have a grandson that's here in the fellowship, and my oldest daughter is also in the fellowship. You know, when I first got here, and they talked about God and a higher power, and I didn't understand because I had grown up in Chicago with my mother. My parents separated when I was 5 years old. That was my first loss, my father. And my mother was a single parent, working, very religious, raising my brother and myself. But the church we attended, no offense to the Baptists, but it was a Baptist church. And I grew up being taught that God was a punishing God. And everything that you did outside of the church was a sin. So you weren't allowed to date. You weren't allowed to go to movies. Definitely weren't allowed to have sex. And as I grew up, those were the things that I wanted to do. No dancing allowed. None of that. I come here and finding a God of my understanding that's a loving God. I truly believe that all of the mistakes that I've made, all of the things that I've done, some I remember, some I don't, which is probably a good thing. You know, blackouts sometimes are lifesavers. I know in my situation, there were some things I didn't want to know about. But I say that because I was thinking about the topic when I received my invitation, and the first thing that came to mind was just being here and being a part of this 70th anniversary celebration. To me, that alone is my sense of belonging. Because When I got here, I didn't know who I was, what I was, or why I was. But today, I honestly believe that I am a spiritual being, living in a spiritual universe, and I'm guided by the 12 spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, one day at a time. And to me, I had no doubt in my mind when I came to my first meeting that I didn't belong. It was just something inside of me made me feel that this is what I had been searching for all my life. And I had finally come home. Because I had been through 3 marriages. Didn't belong in any of them. I had traveled. I had been places. Didn't belong anywhere I went. And so I always felt alone, even though it may have been a room full of people. So each time I would get into another relationship, another situation, looking for love in all the wrong places, and I still felt empty and unfulfilled. And by God's grace, He saved my life and sent me to you. I grew up in Chicago, as I said, and my third husband, he and I both were products of Chicago, and we decided we didn't want to bring the kids up there, so we relocated to Cleveland, Ohio. Now, I had been drinking in Chicago, but it was, I guess, social drinking? Because I didn't get in any trouble, no consequences, and I remember what I had done. So when we relocated to Cleveland, the first thing I discovered was that the drinking pattern was different. You start at the state store, you have to start at a pint of liquor, and then you drink that pint with 3 or 4 people, and then you go back for a fifth, and then it gradually increases to a half a gallon. I thought that I would never, ever stop drinking once I crossed over into alcoholism. Because my husband had been sentenced to life. He was tried for the chair, but he was sentenced to life. And there I was in a new city. This was about a year or so after we moved to Cleveland. With 4 kids, I have 2 sons and 2 daughters, and most of the people that we had met were drinkers. So now I began to drink because I got this poor me. Here I am by myself and with these kids and poor me. During this time that the husband was incarcerated, my only brother was murdered, and my father committed suicide. My grandfather passed. And these were the 4 men in my life at that time that I loved dearly. And so now I'm thinking, God, is this punishing God? Because He's removed all of the men in my life that I truly loved. It didn't take long for my alcoholism to get completely out of control. And by the time this husband come home 10 years later, I was a full-blown alcoholic. My oldest son came home from college one weekend, and me and the bootlegger, she and I was at the house drinking, and my son walked into the house and looked at me and looked at her and looked at the bottle sitting on the table, stereo blasting. And instead of me being glad to see him, I started taxing him for coming home without calling me. When I finished ranting and raging and all that, he said to me, he said, Mama, did it ever occur to you that you might have a drinking problem? Now, I didn't know what he meant by that, but I tell you what I felt. I felt he was being disrespectful. Because after all, I was his mother. How dare he talk to me like that? But I thank God for him today because God used him to do a divine intervention on me, his mother. And what happened was ever since I would drink that, I would always wonder, what did he mean by that? But you know I wasn't about to ask him because I'm the mother. He's the child. See how God worked? And anyway, eventually I came to one night after I passed out on the couch and it was before a day. And one of our public service announcements was playing on the TV. And it said, do you know anyone with a drinking problem? Can you see what it's doing to them or do you see what it's doing to you? Something to that effect. But it's one of our public service announcements that airs on TV. And the light bulb went off because I heard drinking problem. I wrote the number down. They had the number to the central office and, I wrote that down, and I didn't use it then, but I want to take you up to my last drink. When I came to during the holiday of 1975, I had promised my husband I was not going to drink, and I meant that. I was not going to drink for my birthday, which is just before Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, nothing during the holiday. Well, what happened was when I came to Christmas, he was trying to spoon feed me some vegetable soup because he said I had to eat something I hadn't eaten. And I don't know when, what the time frame was. And I don't ever want to forget that because he was trying to give me juice and soup and all of this and nothing would stay down. And I was feeling so sick that, you know, I prayed this prayer again, God, if you just let me get over this, I'll never drink another drop of alcohol. Well, next time I came to, it was New Year's, and I woke up, came to, nobody was in the house but me. I swore I was not going to drink, but now I'm so nervous and shaking, and I feel like my whole insides are coming out. So when New Year's came in for 1976, I was on my way to the bootleggers to get something to drink. When I came to again, it was Valentine's. So whatever transpired between New Year's and Valentine's, I really don't know. But what I do know is when I came to, I remembered, the first thing I remembered was that number I had got off TV about the drinking problem. And I felt that if I stayed there in the house, I was going to die. It was just like God was intervening in my life, let me know that it was time to surrender. And that's what I did. I ended up calling Alcoholics Anonymous, and the gentleman that answered the phone told me, he gave me my first sense of hope and said that I didn't have to live like this anymore. He sent a lady out. At that time, we did 12-step calls. Treatment hadn't become... They didn't have treatment at that time. So you detoxed on K-Ro syrup and orange juice. And that's what I did. And he told me that someone would be out to talk to me. A lady came. She shared her story with me. And I could identify because she had been the drunk mother, the drunk daughter, the drunk wife. And this lady was beautiful. I just couldn't believe that she had been like I was. But when she got through sharing her story, I could believe her. And she gave me my sense of hope that I didn't have to live like that anymore. Now, this is where my sense of belonging really came in, because when I went to my first meeting, even though I didn't understand anything that they were talking about, I had been to college, but I couldn't read, couldn't write, barely knew my name. I had to find out, I had to become, as a little child, my sponsor told me I had to re-educate my mind. And she said, Mary, this journey that you're going to be on is going to give you a new life and a new plan for living. I didn't doubt her. God rest her soul. Her name was Bernice Fisher. She became my sponsor and literally spoon-fed me the program. But she was the one that made me feel that I belong, that I was at home. I had finally come home and was everything that I had been seeking and searching for was right here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where my journey began. It has taken me to service. I had the honor and the privilege of becoming the delegate of Northeast Ohio, which is truly, truly, a remarkable experience. I never will forget, the trustee at the time was Jack Whitehouse. And when we were at the General Service Conference, every day when he would come and meet with us, he would tell us, you're always in by saying that, Dr. Bob said a fellowship come down to two things, love and service. He said, and that's true. But just remember that service is love with your work clothes on. Yeah, because it's a lot of responsibility. And he was, that was so true. But it also let me know that God had really put me where I belong, because everything that we discuss at the General Service Conference impacts on Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And I just felt like here I was, when she was singing Amazing Grace last night, all I could think about was, here I am, a wretch like me that God has saved, got me sober, brought me to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I have family and friends. That's my grandson, everybody. That's Junior. I've met people, I've traveled, I've been in places that I never dreamed of, and it's just been a wonderful journey. I can't say enough about service, because service to me is the key. It's the glue that holds the fellowship together. And for many people, they feel that, oh, no, that's politics. I don't want to be bothered with that. And my sponsor said, but I always tell them this. If you're going to sponsor someone, you want to pass on accurate, factual information and not somebody else's opinion. And that's what service does. It makes you become an informed member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that was another reason why I began to feel like I said, well, gee, I thank you, God, for putting me here. And I sponsor a lot of people into service in my area. The other thing that gave me a sense of belonging was when I felt in... my first international was in Montreal in 1985, and Lois was still alive. And it was so emotional because she read the last letter that Bill W. had written, and everybody in the stadium, I believe, was crying. The next one was in Seattle, and in Seattle, Russia came into Alcoholics Anonymous, which was another miracle. And for those of you that were in the stadium last night, you saw China coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's a power greater than ourselves, doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And it's just shows me how God is working with us. The I am responsible statement. I learned that statement when I first got involved in service. And I still use it because I know that God has saved my life and I want to pass it on like it was given to me. I don't want to change anything in the fellowship. I want it to be just like it was when I got here. Because not only did Alcoholics Anonymous save my life, but it has given me a life. I truly, truly believe today that I belong. I have friends here. I have family here, you know, and I'm just so full, so I'm trying to get through this. Everybody in my family is deceased. I only have me and my four kids. And I feel that God had a plan for me long before I knew I would be here with you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because he knew that I needed to be with the best family in the world. And I thank you for that. So I'm going to close by saying I love you, I salute you, and I thank you for my life.